Remember late last year when it came out that Child Protective Services had failed to investigate thousands of cases? Child welfare advocates do. And they're watching as CPS gets a fresh start.
I'm satisfied that things are being worked on. It's a big unknown what will emerge, what a bill will look like when it emerges into the public eye.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the future of Arizona's Child Welfare Agency.
Also, wildland firefighters prepare for what is expected to be a long fire season.
Hate to wait, Valley companies are working to let you know exactly how long you'll be in line. And it's March Madness of a different kind, as startups compete for cash.
Many people think Silicon Valley is the only place that has a budding startup community, but I think this proves that, you know, at the end of the day, Arizona really does have something to offer.
Plus, looking for tranquility in downtown Phoenix, and in an unrelated story, the arts seem to be exploding in the area.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Looking like a very nice weekend, very similar to what we've had the last several days, partly to mostly sunny skies and high temperatures around 80 degrees or so. Currently, it's mostly sunny and 77 here in the valley. Quick check of traffic. One accident could be causing you a problem. It's on the 101 westbound at 7th Avenue.
In the news this hour, Tempe police say a Tempe school resource officer accidentally fired her department-issued taser during a demonstration, hitting a student in the arm with one probe. Tempe police say the female officer was doing a show and tell this afternoon for an 8th grade class. They say she pushed a button that tests whether the taser is working. Police say the officer then mistakenly pulled the trigger and one of the two probes hit a 14-year-old girl in the left arm. The student was taken to a hospital where she had the probe removed.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has designated all of Arizona's natural disaster area for drought. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports Arizona's 15 counties were covered under the declaration this month.
This means Arizona farmers and ranchers will be able to apply for federal emergency loans. The money will help farmers cover expenses they incurred because of the drought. Jack Peterson is interim director of the Arizona Department of Agriculture. He says farmers have to show a loss because of the weather to qualify.
You know, in a situation like this, the person must be in a spot if he needs to go in and get money to help cover, you know, if he had to rent additional land or purchase feed or whatever effect it may have had.
Peterson says Apache, Coconino, Yavapai, Greenlee, Navajo, and Mojave counties were added to the natural disaster drought area designation this month. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
With all the talk about religious freedom, Common Core, and a host of other issues, it can be easy to forget that lawmakers are also working on basically starting over with Child Protective Services. Late last year, the agency revealed it hadn't investigated more than 6,500 reports of child abuse and neglect. And in January, Governor Brewer started the process of separating CPS from its parent agency, the Department of Economic Security. Dana Namark with Children's Action Alliance says things are moving in the right direction.
The future is much brighter than the past, and that's paramount. Clearly, the future is going to be CPS being a separate state agency. I think there's great consensus that it's time to do that, and that will be beneficial for kids. But that is much more complex than simply, you know, waving a pen and saying you are now separate. So there's a lot of work going on now to figure out how to separate the agencies in a very strategic and effective way. I think the aim of Governor Brewer is to have that new agency begin July 1, but that will really depend on the legislature because that will take legislative action.
Yeah, I mean, how realistic a goal do you think that is?
It's very quick, and I think it is possible to start the new agency July 1. I think there will still be a lot of operational overlap and interaction in the coming year, but that should work fine as long as everybody's on the same page and going in the same direction.
There's a bill moving through the state legislature that would call for an external review of CPS. Do you think that's a good idea?
We do, and we have been for a long time suggesting to lawmakers that we do need some outside expertise to help us as we create this new agency, as we really start over and recreate our strategies for working with children and families.
Do you think there's still the momentum at the Capitol to deal with CPS that there was at the beginning of the session or even, you know, before the session when it was revealed about all these cases that weren't investigated?
We do. Obviously, a lot of the work and the drafting and the discussion of different ideas is now happening in a small group, a work group convened by Governor Brewer. So I think many legislators have not been part of those specific conversations, but there is momentum for change. I think there is very broad agreement that we must do better and we can do better. There's a lot to do, and we don't necessarily expect all of it will be done in one piece of legislation, but we do expect that whatever legislation is passed should set up a framework for that type of success and that type of child safety in the future.
Are you optimistic that the bill or bills that are needed to do to CPS what you think needs to be done will be finished in time? I mean, this is an election year. Lawmakers want to get out of the Capitol and start campaigning and raising money. There's also the issue of making sure that there's room in the budget for whatever amount of money is needed to do these things.
We are optimistic. But again, we don't expect that everything will be completed. We expect this is a process that will go over several years and will actually need ongoing monitoring and accountability from the media, from stakeholders, forever.
So it sounds like overall you're satisfied with the progress that's been made so far.
I'm satisfied that things are being worked on. It's a big unknown what will emerge, what a bill will look like when it emerges into the public eye.
Dana Namark, President and CEO of Children's Action Alliance, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
We once again step out on the ledge to take a look at goings-on at the state capitol. Some of the bills lawmakers voted on this week brought more attention to the Copper Dome, not CNN attention, but attention nonetheless. To recall the week at the Cap, we called on Jim Small, who helps run the show at Arizona Capital Times.
There have been a number of issues that the legislature has been grappling with. Common Core was definitely a big part of the debate this week down at the Capitol, really in the sense of whether the state should continue with implementing these higher education standards that have been adopted by, I want to say, about 40 states across the country, or whether Arizona should be the first state to formally back out of using them.
Does it appear as though this issue is settled, at least for now?
I think it is, at least in terms of whether the standards are going to be in place. I think really the battle now shifts into funding, into what kind of funding does the state provide to implement these standards, to train teachers, to put in some of the infrastructure needed. And then beyond that, what is the state willing to pay for a test?
And continuing the theme of taking up issues that have been dealt with in the past, and in this case, the recent past, the House wants to impose some new restrictions on Medicaid recipients.
Yeah, there was a bill that was approved yesterday that would essentially say that people who are able-bodied, able to work basically, can't be on Medicaid unless they're in a job training program or something similar to that. And it would also, I think more importantly, it would put a 5-year lifetime cap on enrollment in the Access Medicaid program.
Where do we stand with the budget? I mean, we're in almost the middle of March now, and folks want to get out of here in, what, six, 8 weeks or so? Where do we stand with that?
Right now, there's talks happening between staff, between the House and Senate staff, and they're meeting with the governor on a regular basis. But right now, the serious discussions haven't started yet. I would imagine that'll start to pick up soon, but we'll see. It really has kind of been on the back burner for the most part.
So we're going to be seeing some potentially vacant seats at the state capitol in the not-too-distant future. Do you think that we'll be seeing more now that Kyrsten Sinema has decided she's not running in CD7? Will that entice more current legislators to potentially jump into that race?
Well, we've already got two who are going to run, Representative Ruben Gallego and State Senator Steve Gallardo. Representative Gallego plans to leave. He'll be out of office by, a week from now. He's not going to be a state representative anymore. He'll be full-time on the campaign trail. I don't know what Senator Gallardo is going to do. Haven't heard yet whether he's planning on leaving. Beyond that, there's a couple other legislators who have said that they're open to it and they're considering the idea. Senator Anna Tovar, the Senate Minority Leader, is one of them. House Minority Leader Chad Campbell has been asked about it. Neither one of them has made a decision yet, but I think most observers don't expect them to jump ship to go into that race. It's going to be a very crowded field, very short campaign, and not a whole lot of time to raise money.
Given some of the results that we've seen recently with Senate Bill 1062, the defeat of Common Core, do you think it's safe to say that at least when it comes to making sure that legislation it doesn't like doesn't get through, is the business community back? Does it have its mojo back now?
The business community, I think, is really making a renewed effort to influence what happens down at the state capitol. In the past 15 years, they've really seen their power kind of wane a little bit. Now there are these high profile issues where you do see business groups really taking a boisterous role in supporting or opposing things in a way that we really haven't seen in the recent past. And I think you're going to continue to see more of that, both on the campaign trail and at the Capitol.
Do you foresee any more issues coming up this year that's going to bring Anderson Cooper to Arizona?
Well, no, but to be fair, I don't think anyone foresaw that Senate Bill 1062 was going to be bringing Anderson Cooper to Arizona. That was something that really caught most everybody by surprise in terms of how vitriolic and widespread the reaction was to that bill.
Jim Small with Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks.
You're welcome.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. In cities around the country and here in Arizona, the sense of well-being is tied very closely to the value of our homes and the sense of how housing is doing locally. There is now a way to look at this in a visual data form using a new tool from the Demand Institute.
Starting with the assumption that the behavior of local housing markets coupled with income and employment data together can be powerful predictors of local and national economic conditions, they've produced a map. I mean, that just makes good sense, right? Well, what makes even more sense is to actually take a look at this data in the map format presented by the Demand Institute. Joining us now is Louise Keeley, Chief Research Officer for the Demand Institute, co-author of the report on economic conditions around the country. Louise, welcome.
Hi.
So you're calling this a tale of 2,000 cities, in a sense. Is that the number of cities that you looked at, or is it even more than that?
We looked at 2,200 cities and towns in the U.S. All of these towns are incorporated with populations of 15,000 or more in 2011. And we looked at a range of variables related to housing and other indicators of community well-being in each of them.
And housing stands out as a major indicator, but it's certainly not the only one. And you've divided all of these cities of 15,000 population and above into nine categories: affluent, metro, burbs, cosmopolitan suburbs, traditional suburbs. Go down the list, and if you can blurb me a characteristic that describes these nine categories.
Sure. So we looked at this data, and we developed nine community profiles across the U.S., from the most successful communities to the most struggling. So starting with our affluent metroburbs, the most successful, these are the most affluent, wealthiest communities, both in terms of income as well as in terms of home prices. These tend to be small, very densely populated cities that are sometimes nearer to larger metropolitan areas. And in some ways, these places provide an ideal mix of urban living and suburban living, so many of the amenities of urban living, but without some of the challenges. The next two segments or profiles are suburban, our cosmopolitan suburbs, and our traditional suburbs. Cosmopolitan suburbs are also very affluent, very high rates of homeownership, and these are some of the fastest growing places in the U.S. Some of these places literally grew over 1,000% between 2000 and 2012, and they just have a very suburban feel. Traditional suburbs, also high rates of homeownership, relatively affluent, tend to be more stable in terms of the boom and the bust in home prices, and are more established suburban communities.
I'm actually playing with the map. It's actually quite fun. You can find your region. You can find the dense populations of affluent metro burbs next to traditional suburbs, the cosmopolitan, fast-growing places that you describe. All right, what's a vacation retirement destination? That's the next category.
So these are places. They tend to be in the Sun Belt. They're warmer weather, and they're places where people go on vacation, as well as the kind of the cliche of people retiring to Florida. They're these types of places. These places saw big rises and big falls in prices during the housing boom and the housing crisis.
Now, smack in the middle are the historic skyline cities. I suspect that's where I am, in New York, right?
Yep. So historic skyline cities, these are the most densely populated places in the U.S. They include places like New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, but also some smaller cities that still are very densely populated and have a very urban feel to them, places like Providence, Rhode Island, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that we highlight in the report. These are places that have lower income than our most successful community profiles, but still have a lot to offer to people who live there. They're relatively expensive, however. And they're in some of our oldest cities are there, too. These are some of our older cities.
And smack in the middle is transitional cities. And right at the bottom, I'll just finish the list for you, are deflated bubble communities, challenged communities, and endangered communities. These are places that are really having some trouble. A few words about transitional cities. Did they avoid the recession?
Yeah, the transitional cities in some ways are the most interesting group of cities. It's 377 cities, 39 million people live there. And, when we look at the boom and the bust in prices, transitional cities actually had kind of the mildest rise and decline of many places. So, relative to some places in the country, they did avoid the destabilizing effects of the housing crisis.
So with all due sort of concern for our neighbors in endangered communities and challenged communities and deflated bubble communities, I suspect the areas around Las Vegas would be places that would qualify as deflated bubble communities. What should we watch to gauge the general economic health of the nation? Or is it really a community by community picture at this point?
It's both. So I think the reason why we developed these profiles is so that one can get a quantified, clear sense of what the landscape is of communities across the country. But the reality is that every community has its own story. So if I look at endangered communities, these are the most struggling. These are places where population growth has been low or declining. Employment growth often is negative. Poverty rates are high. Incomes are low. So that's a general picture. But then the reasons why each community is in the situation it's in and what the possibilities are to bring it out and to bring it into a more successful course, it's going to vary community by community.
All right. The Louise Keeley, Chief Research Officer for the Demand Institute, co-author of this report called 2,000 Cities, actually a survey of more than 2,000 cities of population 15,000 or more. Louise, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. We've been playing with the map a little bit around here, and it got some interesting things to say about the Valley. The Demand Institute lists four cities as transitional: Phoenix, Mesa, Tempe, and Glendale. Remember, these are older inland cities undergoing transition and have a higher reliance on government jobs to sustain the local economy.
Five Valley cities are considered cosmopolitan suburbs, which are fast-growing contemporary suburbs that offer distinctive services and wide-ranging amenities. Those cities are Gilbert, Goodyear, Avondale, Buckeye, and Queen Creek. Chandler and Peoria are listed as traditional suburbs, which the Demand Institute defines as solid middle-class communities that represent a cornerstone of American family life.
In an area known for both vacationers and retirees, only two cities get listed in that category, Scottsdale and Fountain Hills. The guess here is that one is the former and the other the latter.
And there's one more Valley city on the list. El Mirage is considered a deflated bubble city, which is defined as an ethnically diverse community hit hard by the real estate bubble and bust over the last decade.
A few other cities of note in Arizona: Flagstaff is listed as a vacation and retirement destination, as are Payson, Prescott, Bullhead City, Lake Havasu City, Yuma, and Oro Valley.
And the map lists Tucson as a transitional city. Now, if you enjoy maps as much as we do, and I frankly find that hard to believe, you can check this one out for yourself at kjzz.org. Just click on the show page.
Still to come, wildland firefighters from across the valley got a refresher this week.
We review the past fires that have occurred, and we gain from those experiences. We try and review those and learn from every fire. There's no latest techniques or new technology out there for us right now.
Getting ready for another fire season. That's ahead. It's the show. Looks like another nice weekend around the valley. If you like above normal temperatures, it'll be partly to mostly sunny both Saturday and Sunday, with a high of 80 tomorrow and then 82 on Sunday. Currently mostly sunny and 77 degrees.
In Valley traffic, an accident 101 westbound. That's in the North Valley, blocking the on-ramp at 7th Avenue. Also an accident blocking the shoulder 101 northbound in the West Valley. That's at Camelback.
KJZZ is supported by Circle the City, a local nonprofit medical center, providing the homeless of Maricopa County a time and place to heal from periods of illness and injury. Opportunities to donate or volunteer at circlethecity.org.
When you hear the phrase venture capital, what's your reaction? Now, be honest, because for most of us, visions of high-tech firms, Aaron Sorkin-esque walk-and-talks, and huge piles of stock options pop into our heads. Reality, though, is a lot different. Imagine you're the CEO of a startup company that just launched this year. You've got a cool idea, but you need to fund it and market it, or it'll flop. So what do you do? How about compete against 15 other startups in a high-speed pitching battle for the chance to win a part of $50,000 in cash prizes?
Each of the companies will make a five-minute presentation.
Oh, yeah, and you only have 5 minutes to convince your judges you're better than your opponent. Venture Madness is a business competition presented by Invest Southwest. The company's chair, Jonathan Ariano, says the idea was to gamify traditional business pitching.
Sort of a Shark Tank meets March Madness.
Shark Tank is a reality show on ABC where judges decide whether to invest in aspiring entrepreneurs. Venture Madness works much the same way. On Thursday, 16 presenters went head-to-head at Talking Stick Resort. They pitched in front of a panel of experienced business leaders in hopes of making it to the next round of eight. Ariano says these 16 were originally in a pool of 64 companies that were whittled down in an online judging process, and those 64 came from a pool of 119 applicants across the Southwest. The final round is this afternoon, and tonight the first Venture Madness winner will be crowned and awarded $30,000. The competitor's goal is to win that title, but Ariano says the event's main goal is to showcase what Southwest companies have to offer.
Many people think Silicon Valley is the only place that has a budding startup community, but I think this proves that, you know, at the end of the day, Arizona really does have something to offer.
Jim Gulka is managing director at the Arizona Technology Investor Forum. He's attending Venture Madness this afternoon. Gulka is involved in venture capital and angel investing. Jim, what are you looking for? What kind of questions do you ask before deciding whether you want to invest in a potential business?
We are principally focused on a very specific thing. What's the problem you're solving? And who has the problem? In other words, it's not about a good idea, but it's about the application of that good idea into a marketplace. Somebody needs something to be changed. And if you have a good change agent, people will buy it and the business will grow.
How much money are we talking about here? What's a low-end and what's a high-end investment?
In our group, Angel Group, we're 75 people that do this together in Phoenix. We're interested in companies that need to raise between $500,000 and $2 million. And venture funds typically start at investing $2 million and will go up to hundreds of millions.
Jim, has it been the case that the Phoenix area has been an especially tough market for venture capital for angel investors, especially since the economic downturn?
The answer is it has absolutely been the case for the simple reason that for people who had the ability to invest in things other than the New York Stock Exchange or government bonds or whatever, they could do very well investing in real estate in Phoenix or in Tucson, anywhere in the state. That sucked up most of this money. With the economic downturn, there was even fewer dollars to be spent. But now the economy is growing again, and technologies are becoming more interesting to more people. And as a result, we're seeing more entrepreneurial businesses being started here, so it's actually growing quite dramatically. Our group of 75 people 3 years ago was about 20.
And Jim, overall, what makes this a more challenging market than Silicon Valley, San Diego, Boston, for example?
In some other places, new technology businesses have been more central to the economy. Here, we just didn't have that happen. So while there have been people doing new technologies all around, coming out of ASU, doing it as, you know, people leaving large technology companies like Intel or Motorola, or Honeywell and starting their own businesses, they were often dispersed around the valley. So the way we characterize it is the connective tissue among people is thinner here than it is in places like Silicon Valley or Boston or even Austin, Texas. If you have people who are interested in the same kinds of things that you are, you find that resources to collaborate, and then you make exciting things happen. The weakness that we have is this lack of connectivity among people. We're changing that.
Jim Gulka, Managing Director of the Arizona Technology Investor Forum.
Wildland firefighters from across the valley had their annual training this week, getting refreshers on everything from communications equipment to using portable water tanks to deploying fire shelters. The Central Arizona Wildland Response Team has put on the event for the past decade for local, state, and federal agencies. Lou Mirabelli is a captain with Rural Metro Fire Department and says every year firefighters go back to basics.
There's nothing really new out here. What we do is we review the past fires that have occurred and we gain from those experiences. We try and review those and learn from every fire. There's no latest techniques or new technology out there for us right now. So every year we get together here with the Central Arizona Wildland Response Team and we bring it back to basics. We cover the basics and make sure everybody's got the basic foundation well instilled in themselves, and we can move forward from there throughout the season.
Last year's fire season obviously was marked by one very big incident for people who do what you do. What are you taking from what happened last year at Yarnell?
With any tragedy, fire, or disaster, or injury, we try and learn from that.
One of the findings from the Yarnell Hill Fire Serious Accident Investigation Team was that the firefighter shelters, quote, stood no chance against the fire. At this week's training, firefighters practiced deploying them and communicating once they had.
Fire's here! Fire's here! Set your feet, get in your shelters!
Trainers would rattle the practice shelters to simulate the wind they'd experience. Andrew Mandel, a fire prevention officer on the Tonto National Forest, says something's gone wrong if firefighters have to use them. But he says the training for that possibility isn't changing because of the Yarnell Hill fire.
Training is training year in and year out. You know, as far as preparing for a fire season, it's, we have checklists and things that we do, and it's business as usual as far as that's concerned from what I've seen.
Pass the message. Yankees are great.
Daisy Mountain, great.
Daisy Mountain, copy.
Before they get out of their shelters, the firefighters communicate a message from one to the next. Rural Metro's Lou Mirabelli compares it to a game of telephone. And he says a lot of the techniques and equipment used today aren't all that different from what's been used in the past.
There's just nothing new out there right now. We always, what we do is we learn. Experiences are huge with us. We teach each other. We communicate our experiences with each other. With what we do, there's technology is always going to advance, but right now there's nothing really for us out there that's the latest and breaking, you know, the holy grail of wildland firefighting, if you will. So,
are people working on trying to get that?
I'm sure they are. There are organizations out there that are always trying to do technological advances. You know, our pumps, our fire trucks, from what they were 20 years ago to what they are now, are a little bit more advanced as technology comes to us. But the basics of what we do is still the same.
Sounds like maybe more gradual changes than one, as you say, holy grail of fireland, of wildland fire.
There's going to be some gradual changes over the next 10 years and so on and so forth. So the way that we do fuel mitigation projects, prevention programs are huge.
Now, despite some of the mud and puddles around us now, it's been, as you well know, a very dry winter. What kind of fire season are you preparing for?
We're expecting an above average fire season that we're predicting is going to kick off a little bit earlier this year. We had a light snowpack. We've had an extensive drought, as we always have. You've seen some rain come in. That fuel is going to grow and die out here relatively quickly. So we're expecting this to occur earlier than normal.
But that may not be set in stone. Diane Vosick of the Ecological Restoration Institute at NAU says the jury's still out on whether the state gets more rain later this spring.
If we get a lot of rain in April and May, that can help blunt the danger of fire season, but it can also contribute to increased growth in understory, which could lead to increased fuels in June.
Vosick says those fuels are the only fire variable people can control, so she says the state needs to be more assertive about doing that.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Blake Davis, and I'm on a mission right now with my GCU teammates to make this team and school a powerhouse. A lot of these guys, me included, we've been playing our whole lives, and it's something that has always been consistent. It's a relationship just like any other, but it never does you wrong. You have to create your own mental energy, you know, just be mentally strong and not worry about what your body feels like. We still have a lot of work to do. We still have possibly a postseason tournament.
Blake Davis at practice with the GCU basketball team at Grand Canyon University in Phoenix. The team has one game left. That's tomorrow night at 6 p.m. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Looks like a nice weekend on tap for the Phoenix area with sunny skies, highs in the lower 80s. One quick traffic note, 101 southbound in the East Valley. An accident at the 202 Santan has the left lanes blocked.
KJZZ is supported by University of Arizona Outreach College, offering over 50 online graduate degrees and certificates. Learn more at oc.arizona.edu/NPR. U of A, opportunity, innovation, impact.
Do you find yourself getting more impatient? Does the microwave popcorn take too long? Is that 60-second wait for minute rice making you uncomfortable? Perhaps recognizing our need to know just how long pretty much everything takes, Arizona's motor vehicle offices started putting information online about how long you'll have to wait in line. That's also been a recent development in hospital emergency rooms. Health economist Marjorie Baldwin of the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU explains the healthcare implications.
No matter what level of insurance an individual has to cover their health care, they incur costs when they receive health care. And part of those costs are the time that they spend waiting. And so waiting time matters to people. It's well known that if you have a non-life-threatening emergency and you show up at the emergency room, you're going to be put in a queue. And there are stories about waiting hours and hours in the emergency room. If people don't have a non-life-threatening emergency, they can look to see what the waiting times are, and they can reduce those wait times by going to an emergency room that will serve them quicker, and that reduces their costs of consuming the health care.
If someone sees wait time is 27 minutes, do they need to take that with a grain of salt to some extent, since we're talking about medical care?
Yes, because obviously an emergency room is there to treat life-threatening emergencies. And if suddenly there were a horrible car accident or something else that brought a lot of people into the emergency room, and you showed up thinking you were going to wait only 5 minutes, that might change. So interestingly, these websites that I've looked at, they update those waiting times very frequently, every 10 minutes or so. And that's because it's going to change depending on what else is coming into the emergency room. And it's important here to note, if you have a real life-threatening emergency, you don't have time to look up for wait times. And it doesn't matter, because when you get to the emergency room, if you have a life-threatening condition, you're going to go to the front of the queue and be treated right away. So posting wait times is almost advertising to get people with non-life-threatening emergencies to come to the emergency room, which is kind of paradoxical.
What if you're in a situation that is nowhere close to being life or death? You could be waiting on the phone to order a wedding gift or find out why your cable is out. You still want to know how long it's going to take. W.P. Carey School Marketing Professor Mary Jo Bittner.
Businesses today understand that time is really one of the most precious assets that their customers have, and they want to create, you know, satisfied and loyal customers. So they're, you know, one reason they do it is that they're conscious of the time constraints that their customers have, and they know that efficient and effortless service is what people really want and expect. So this is one way to try to control that and give people a sense of some control over their time.
Is there a danger of a slippery slope if you raise the expectations too high for customers as far as the wait time, and they may lead to problems in the future?
Overall, promising a specific wait time is probably a little bit dangerous because depending on your industry, there's so many things that happen and that are uncontrollable for businesses that to make some overall statement about always what the waiting time will be is probably somewhat of a slippery slope. But to monitor waiting times and give people a heads up or let them call or let them know when they do call in or come in, you know, what the wait time will be, that I think is a pretty good strategy because people, what we know about waiting time is that people want to feel that they've been treated fairly. We also know that they prefer certainty to uncertainty.
ASU Marketing Professor Mary Jo Bittner explaining why sometimes waiting is not the hardest part.
While we must and will win this war, we should also remember the high price that will be paid
if the very foundation of modern society is destroyed?
George Clooney's character, Frank Stokes, is talking about the works of art he and his platoon are trying to protect from the Nazis in the movie The Monuments Men. The film is based on a book of the same name written by Robert Edsel. He's written three books on the subject and will be in the Valley this weekend to talk about it. Edsel says it's amazing that more than half a century after World War II, there's a major part of the war that we don't know much about.
The idea of us going to museums and churches and looking at these things today and never wondering where were they during World War II and who were the people that saved them. And it was a question I kind of tripped over when I was living in Florence in 1996, and I didn't know the answer. And I've, in the many years that have passed, asked many, many people, and people shrug their shoulders and say, well, that's a great question. What's the answer? So that's really where it began, was just out of curiosity.
Was it difficult to find the answers?
It was initially, because one of the things that stunned me, World War II is the most documented photographed event in history, and yet there was no book that told this story through images, and it's such a visual story with works of art by, you know, that everybody knows. I mean, whether people like art or not, they're just transcendent. You know, we're talking about works including the Mona Lisa, which has moved around the countryside in France six separate occasions before finally being returned to Paris, the Last Supper almost destroyed by a British bomb by accident, the David entombed in brick. I mean, these are things everybody knows about. And that's why the first book I published, Rescuing Da Vinci, was a photographic telling of the story. But I realized I still wasn't telling the beating heart of the story, which is these men and women who volunteered for service during World War II and why they did what they did.
We have heard of people doing this kind of thing since World War II, most notably, I think, in Iraq and other parts of the Middle East. Do you think that what the Monuments Men and Women did during World War II sort of set the stage for some of the efforts in following conflicts?
Well, there's no question that Monuments officers stay in Europe until 1951. Their work at the end of the war is really just beginning. In 1954, there were laws, the Hague Convention, that placed a requirement on all countries to have some effort to preserve the cultural treasures in their own country. The problem was countries that signed it, including the United States, Syria, and others, you know, it just doesn't have any teeth. And unfortunately for our country, in the aftermath of the American-led invasion in 2003, our leaders forgot this important legacy that was left to us. And we didn't have cultural preservation officers. We didn't have monuments men and women there with the troops during the invasion of Iraq. And there were horrible destructions to the museum and the National Library and archives. So that's part of the work, not just of the books I've written, but the Monuments Men Foundation, which I'm the chairman of, to raise worldwide awareness and reestablish these high standards for the protection of cultural treasures during war.
Robert Edsel, author of The Monuments Men, as well as other books about the discovery and survival of artwork during World War II. He'll be speaking at the Tempe Center for the Arts Sunday evening in an event put on by the Phoenix Art Museum.
Researchers have found that identical twins feel pain differently. These twins are generally genetically identical, and so it seems likely that environmental factors are causing their different perceptions of pain. The BBC's Marnie Chesterton speaks to the author of the study, Professor Tim Spector, from King's College London to find out more. Could the way we live affect the pain we feel?
Identical twin Andrea is lying on a scanner as her sister Nicola waits her turn. They're volunteering for a battery of tests as part of the Twin UK study, the largest twin research group in the world. The man in charge is Professor of Genetic Epidemiology, Tim Spector.
We're at the heart of the twin study here. We're in the clinical research facility on the fourth floor at St Thomas's Hospital. We've got a couple of pairs of twins who've come up for the day for their testing, and these are one of 11,000 twins that we've seen in the last 21 years since we started, exploring a whole range of differences between them and similarities between them, trying to pinpoint what the key genes are or what the key environmental factors are that make them either very different or very similar. And today we're focusing on our pain research.
Research assistant Iron prepares a polystyrene bucket of ice for the pain threshold test.
So Nicola, I'm going to ask you to put your dominant hand in this ice cold water, and then as soon as it becomes unbearable, I'll get you to take your hand out. Is that all right?
That's fine.
So when you're ready, starting now. Yes, that's definitely cold.
More from the ice test later. First, Tim explains why they study twins.
Identical twins are really nature's most powerful experiment because they're genetic clones of each other. They have their identical DNA in every cell of their bodies. So when you compare the two of them, you know that they have exactly the same genes and they came from the same mother, the same family, the same womb. They had the same early upbringing and lifestyle. And so this allows you to pinpoint any differences between them and be able to pick apart those influences that are impossible to do in normal people who don't have a genetic clone to compare with. That's the beauty of the identical twins. And classically, we've always compared them to non-identical twins to find out what is down to nature or what is down to nurture. But we now know that nearly everything is a mix of the two. Everything you study is genetic and also has an environmental component.
Your DNA is fixed, a code you're stuck with all your life. Epigenetics is the way that code can be interpreted and how it reacts to the environment. Imagine your genome as sheet music. Well, the epigenome is the annotation, how loudly or softly you play the notes. Or to use Professor Spector's analogy, epigenetics allows you to regulate the genes up and down like a dimmer switch. His team wanted to know if epigenetic factors linked to certain genes could affect the pain threshold, which involved making life painful for many, many twins.
For the pain project, we took several years to collect around 2,000 of twins and meticulously looked at their pain thresholds. So there was a huge range. In general, the identical twins were more similar than the non-identical twins, showing it was genetic, but there were big differences. And so what we took was we took all the identical twins and we ranked them in terms of who was most different. And so then we got our 25 most different pairs and we did a detailed study on those individuals, a study that looked at their DNA for these epigenetic changes. And what we found was there were 9 genes that had very big differences between the twin with the high and the twin with the low pain threshold. The top genes were all related to pain pathways, and the very top one was this TRPA1 gene, which is well known to lots of pain scientists who have been exploring it for a while, and showed us that what we'd found was not only real but very exciting, because until then we hadn't really known that you could, in theory, switch your genes up and down. And this is potentially of great interest to drug companies developing new painkillers.
The BBC's Marnie Chesterton.
Still to come, looking for some calm in the heart of the city.
This is a very rare sort of thing. Typically, it's commerce that one is making time for downtown and not a peaceful garden.
Calmly checking off another item on the Phoenix bucket list. That's ahead. It's the show.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing their seafood extravaganza with a selection of fresh seafood flown in daily. A list of 11 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
Workers hammered 2-foot nails into the ground Thursday to hold down a large tent. Imagine crews putting up the big top for the circus. But this tent on a vacant lot at 3rd Street in Garfield is not for a classic circus. It's for a carnival of the future.
This carnival is part of Emerge, an annual event created by 3 Arizona State University faculty members.
Our principle has been that to create better futures, you need better dreams.
Ed Finn is director of the ASU Center for Science and the Imagination. He says Emerge challenges engineers, artists, scientists, writers, and more to dream up the future through new ideas.
In its first 2 years, Emerge was a 3-day workshop where participants created a project by the third day. This year, the creators decided to try something new.
We've tried to create these visceral, experiential places and performances and works of art and installations that allow people to touch and feel some vision of the future.
With robots, aerialists, singing drones, and oh yes, there will be carnival games, but instead of popping balloons, players can use a computerized mirror to send themselves into the future by aging their reflection.
Another project shows you what your future self will feel like. ASU Biodesign Institute students envision what it would be like to predict at birth what a person's health will be like over their lifetime using genome sequencing. Under the big top, they'll have a station for people to experience what this type of personalized healthcare might look like in a couple of decades. This isn't your typical carnival booth, but Finn says it's the perfect place to introduce new ideas.
The carnival already takes you out of your own world and puts you somewhere else. And so it immediately puts people into a more open frame of mind to say, okay, let's find out what these people are doing. Let's see what's happening here.
This carnival coincides with another carnival, First Friday. It's also tonight from 6 to 11.
And that's just part of what looks to be an arts explosion this weekend in Phoenix. Art Detour starts tomorrow. That's an annual two-day celebration of the arts in Phoenix. Think of it as a mega First Friday. There's also a mural painting event called Paint Phoenix going on through Sunday, with more than 50 artists painting in areas like Roosevelt Row, Grand Avenue, and along 16th Street. And musicians will perform at 14 different venues Saturday night in the Viva Phoenix Music Festival.
We've been teaming up with Robert Pala and Amy Silverman of New Times, checking off items on their Phoenix bucket list, 100 places in the valley you've got to visit before you die. Today, Mark and Robert go Zen.
Well, Robert and I have searched for some tranquility in the heart of Phoenix, and it appears, at least for the time being, we found it.
For a moment, yeah. I'm hearing what sounds like a lawnmower. On the other hand, this is a very, very well-tended Japanese friendship garden, so we should probably expect to hear machinery from time to time.
So we're at the Japanese Friendship Garden. We're at about Roosevelt and 3rd Avenue in Phoenix. What makes this place so special to you?
You know, I live downtown. I've lived downtown for 30 years, and I have been determined from the beginning to utilize every part of downtown and to frequent every part of downtown. And this is a very rare sort of thing. Typically, it's commerce that one is making time for downtown, and not a peaceful garden like this. This is great. It's so unlike anything else that we have down here.
Why should other people come to see this before they die? What puts this on your bucket list?
It's very different. We have parks downtown. We have Encanto Park. Very nearby, we have Margaret T. Hance Park. It borders this one. But we don't have one that is this ethnocentric, that has this much specific history that isn't about Phoenix. You know, you go to Encanto Park and often it's about the memories of having been there as a child, because the amusement park is there and the duck pond and all of that. But this is really about Japanese history. And this is a sister cities project. Where else would you go for something like this downtown?
It is kind of, I mean, it does have sort of a, you almost forget that you're in Central Phoenix. I mean, if you couldn't see the apartment buildings and hear the traffic, you might for a minute forget that you were in one of the top five or six biggest cities in the country.
And one of the hottest. Yeah. The plants are not necessarily indigenous. Here comes some ducks. There's a lot of wildlife. There's fish, there's ducks, and there's pigeons. I think at the domestic parks here, you just get ducks and maybe trout. Angry ducks.
These ducks are not shy.
No, they're fighting about something.
So we've come a little bit further north and slightly west, gone from the land of peace and zen to retail, right, Robert?
This is my peace and zen right here. This is my milieu.
We are inside Zinnia's, which is a giant warehouse full of, for lack of a better word, stuff.
Old stuff, mostly. It's a lot of antiques and a lot of vintage, and I have got to go look at those books over there and the bookcase that they're in. Oh, it's the Pacific Reporter. Okay. This is an antique mall. Boy, I see about 30 or 40 things that I need to own right now.
This is not the only such place in this area. There's a whole strip of antique and vintage type places here on 7th Avenue, stretching basically from Indian School up to Camelback. What makes this something that was worthy of your bucket list?
7th Avenue is, you know, it's like a lot of collectible and antique districts here. Somebody brought their antique store to 7th Avenue 10, 12 years ago, and then somebody else came, and pretty soon the whole area, same thing happened in Scottsdale Road, And that's what happens with this sort of secondhand and second market retail. This is a really good one, not just because it's close to downtown where I live, but because there are so many specialty shops. There's a place across the street that only sells mid-century things. There's this mall. There's a really great thrift store next door.
Well, so when you come to a place like this, in your mind, do you come looking for something or just looking for something and you see what you find?
No, this is drugs for me. I'm beyond the point of needing anything else. So when I go antiquing now, it's really just to see what's been found. I'm terrified that if things get messy at my house, that Hoarders is going to show up with a crew and some cameras.
On this day, Robert left empty-handed, so no cameras, at least for now. We wrap up our tour of the Phoenix Bucket List next week.
That's how many people have served as governor of Arizona since it became a state in 1912.
But in the last quarter century, the face of the office has changed quite a bit. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez explains.
Arizona has had 13 Democratic governors and 9 Republicans. Some have served 2 and even 3 terms. Most of our state leaders have been men. But did you know Arizona is the first state to have 4 women governors?
The first one, Mofford. And Napolitano, Democrats.
Alice Duckworth is with the Arizona Capitol Museum.
Jane Hull, she was a Republican. Jan Brewer, Republican.
In 1988, Rose Mofford ascended to the position after her predecessor, Evan Meekum, was impeached. Nearly 10 years later, Jane Hull becomes the second woman to take Arizona's highest office. She got the job after Fife Symington resigned. Hull later ran for a full term and became the first woman officially elected governor. But she was not the only woman making history in the state at that time.
But this is a special day because for the first time in the history of anywhere, the top executive positions are all held by women.
1998 was the year of the Fabulous Five. Hull is governor. Betsy Bayless is elected Secretary of State. Janet Napolitano becomes Attorney General. Carol Springer, Treasurer. And Lisa Graham Keegan as Superintendent of Public Instruction. Duckworth shows me memorabilia from this special day.
A signed invitation to the inauguration. So we have all of the ladies have signed it.
Duckworth says she remembers the inauguration vividly. She was there. So was yet another Arizona woman who once made U.S. history, swearing the Fabulous Five into office at the state capitol.
All of them are there with Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve in the U.S. Supreme Court. What a day.
Then in 2002, Arizona elected Janet Napolitano, our third female governor. She made Arizona history again when she won a second term. Napolitano resigned to join President Obama's cabinet as the first woman appointed to Homeland Security Secretary. And that brings us to today. Jan Brewer is the fourth woman elected governor and the third consecutive woman in the state's top job. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things there are no things that you think we ought to know, let us know. The show at KJZZ.org.
A busy weekend coming around the valley, especially if you want to have fun. And Mark, we're all about fun.
Of course. Who doesn't like fun?
Today through Sunday, Chandler Ostrich Festival, all sorts of stuff going on. And Mark, one of our favorite movies, Sideways,
yes,
makes a reference that we can't say on the radio,
yeah,
but about ostriches.
Google it. You'll find out what to think. Drew Carey will be performing at the Tempe Improv tonight through and tomorrow. He, of course, now the host of The Price is Right. He's got that long, skinny microphone.
Yeah, absolutely. Arizona Aloha Festival. I guess we're about to say aloha to you in a minute or so,
yes,
from the show. But great stuff related to Hawaii, storytellers, dancers, drummers, artists, traditional island cuisine. You'll want to try the Moco Loco. Tell them I sent you.
I'm not sure what to make of that. The Professional Bull Riders Bass Pro Shop Shootout is tomorrow and Sunday. The top 35 riders in the world face off in bull riding events. That's at U.S. Airways Center in Phoenix.
And on Saturday in historic downtown Glendale, Paris in the Spring from 10 to 4, an open-air market with all things French, including French food, culture, and shopping, and And mimes, Mark.
Of course. As long as there are no clowns, we're good.
Right,
I think we're okay with mimes. Clowns we're not okay with.
Makeup's still a little sketchy.
Yeah. The show was produced this week by John Hoban, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, with help from Bruce Drummond, Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias, and our news director is Peter O'Dowd.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 3 o'clock.